Social media, reality television. It's never been easier to become one of the bright and beautiful with your image plastered all over for everyone to see and admire. In the 70s and 80s through to the 2000s, people were sometimes approached on the street, at the beach or in a bar by someone claiming to be a photographer or a talent scout, to be handed a business card and offered a photo shoot. Sometimes these offers were genuine and new supermodels emerged. Mostly they were a scam. The slightly less dangerous involved lingerie shoots and sometimes devolved into pornography or sexual assault. The worst resulted in the death of the hopeful wannabe. But what if such a predator left clues that they were in fact possibly a serial killer, but no one acted upon the evidence for 20 years? This is the case of William Richard Bradford, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Murder Me Monday podcast. I'm Cameron and joined with me is Mother.
Hello.
Mother, please go.
So it depends if you fall into two or three victims to be a serial killer, or five like Colin Ireland that we covered in a previous case. But this guy, it's very probable that he's in double digits. Now, going back to the beginning, the big talent agencies for sure did scout for talents, new faces, quirky looks all over. And us oldies will have heard how Agnes Dane was discovered working behind the counter of fish and chip shop here in the UK. I think she's now living a quiet life in the USA, but that was a definite thing that was done. So what are we talking about evidence-wise this week? Photographs. So we've got a one-minute educational section coming up. So there are arguments that it may be even earlier by 500 years, but around 1021, the prototype pinhole camera is evidenced in historical documents. It was more of a projector, but it was the start.
For anyone that hasn't seen it, it's basically a pinhole that has light on the other side that projects an image through the pinhole and then just displays it on the wall. You can get them now. You can actually get them by accident. I saw a picture on Reddit. Someone's curtain had a hole in it. There's a tiny, tiny, like a pinhole, and it just casted the image from their street onto their wall so they could see the outside.
Yeah.
And it's really strange. It's weird how just light going through a very small hole flips itself and projects itself on the wall.
Yeah.
And that was the first camera or the first thing used to display an image.
Yeah, it's a projector, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So the first real photographs, as we know, were taken in 1826. That's how we know them today. But in 1948, the firm Polaroid developed and introduced a device that would take and develop its own photographs, though it was very niche, and they eventually stopped production in 2008. And I'm going to be honest here, they were rubbish, to be honest. Family member had one. They were clunky, boxy. They weren't ergonomic at all. And they were never very good colour or focus wise. They were downright fuzzy and they would actually fade in a really weird way. I remember pulling the photograph out, peeling the strip off it, and then you'd stand there waving it for 10 minutes, waiting for the thing to develop in front of you.
It's iconic though. And it's quite, I remember I was at a party once and someone had one of them. It was cool to have one because obviously my generation doesn't have them. We've pretty much had smartphones since we were kids, and getting a camera like that can take a picture then immediately develop it and have it in your hands is almost quite a novelty.
Yeah,
I quite like them,
and I think that was the trick. If you do find one when you're rooting through your parents or your grandparents' loft at some point, keep it, put it away.
I probably get a new one. That's probably toxic somehow. I'm being honest, there's probably a battery in it that will kill you, so don't use that one. Probably get a new one. There's a lot of old stuff that's coming back in.
Yeah, I mean, you fashion. Can, the films, they're in cartridges and they do come up for sale on, you know, various websites every so often. But I'd be worried about their viability if the chemicals in them are degraded and they're phenomenally expensive. But they weren't really useful for family album. They were actually thick. The photographs were thick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So up until 2000, though, most people took rolls of films to be developed or cartridges and printed in shops or chemists or stores. As Cameron said, most people now have got smartphones, but it was 2000 that it sort of died off. Getting these films developed, this actually led to a problem for these shops and stores. People would often take photographs of something they liked, giving no thought that someone else would actually see this, as it's not an automated process.
The thing is, like, nudes, isn't it? Basically, yeah. They'll take sexy pictures, get them developed, and think, oh, shit.
I unfortunately did fall down some rabbit holes of Victorian nudes photographs.
Yeah.
And they, I suppose you could call them arty, but they're...
Them bitches hairy, because for some reason, like, yeah. As soon as pictures could be taken, people were like, let's do this naked.
Yeah. Get the kit off. Anyway, the law eventually caught up with this. So something showing an illegal act, if somebody took a film in to be developed, they would often find themselves talking to law enforcement about the nature of the images that they actually captured. But sometimes the photographs weren't illegal, maybe risque like we've just talked about, but not illegal between consenting adults. Lots of places will still print nudes and photography. I mean, business is business, right? Let's start at the beginning with this guy as best we can. There's nothing out there on his early life. Family or siblings, etc. He really is an enigma. When his troubles really began, the internet wasn't a thing, so records would be paper or microfiche, and you have to know where to start looking and have the actual resources to go and physically look for these things. So I did the best I could. What was actually gold was finding a court appeal from 1997, which actually had the whole background of the case in it, which was so much better than the news stuff that I did actually find. So nothing seems to be known about this guy's exact birth date or where, except he's American. And he was probably born in either 1946 or 1948. It's a bit woolly.
So I'm gonna ask a question here, and you don't have to answer because it might spoil it. Because you don't know his age, either he was never found or he died before they were able to sort of identify him properly.
If you sometimes do the maths on these things and you don't know, you know, when somebody died and they were given an age in a certain year, you could actually have a 2 year either side. So that's where I'm a bit woolly on that one. So apparently he was married at least 4 times, and there is one son that we know of, probably born in the late 1970s. Let's skip to 1984, when Bill is probably maybe 38 or 40 years old. Like I say, it's a bit wibbly. June 1984. He is in LA, seemingly doing this photographer thing I mentioned in the intro and targeting young women. He ended up on a sexual assault charge. There's no background at all to this charge, but there is a resolution at the end of the episode, which I was pleased to find.
Is that like a photography joke? Resolution?
No. Oh, no. He's sharing an apartment in West LA with a friend and his friend's mother. And he's sleeping on a sofa or a couch. He has a motorbike. Some places it's running, some places it's not. But he doesn't appear to have any money to fix stuff up, or get his own place. But he also had a car. The make and model, again, is a complete and utter mystery. So Billy's out on bail on the sexual assault charge. And he spends time at a bar called the Meat Market. Now, lots of places spell it meat as in to greet someone. But the court records I did manage to dig up had it spelt as meat as in steak. He spent a lot of time there with a young woman called Shari Miller, who had just turned 21 years old. She used to work at the bar, but was currently picking up odd jobs, house painting, essentially homeless and living in her car, although she did used to go and stay with her mother from time to time. Unfortunately, it seems that she may have had a drug dependency issue, so her life was somewhat chaotic.
I was going to ask that. Why would she live in her car and then sometimes with her mother? Probably some sort of substance abuse, I'd imagine.
But... yeah, there was, and there is a relevant part. She gets injured and I think she goes to her mother's for comfort, for some kind of sanctuary, but she only stays there for a couple of days. Maybe she can't deal with the rules and regulations living with a mum, even at 21. Shari had told friends of meeting a wealthy photographer with motorbikes and a boat who was going to pay her for a photo shoot modelling leather outfits. But she was very clear to the friends that there would be no nudity. Now, multiple witnesses saw Shari with Bill Bradford between the 1st and the 3rd of July 1984. No one sees her on the 4th, although friends were expecting her to turn up. And his housemates, well, the mother of the housemate, didn't see Bill either on the 4th. So 6 a.m, 6th of July, a guy turns up for work in West LA and notices a large bundle in the car park. Records don't show what happened, but it took until 9:50 a.m, so nearly 4 hours, for police to turn up to what was described as A blood-stained quilt with a hand visible and a strong odour. There's some gruesome bits coming up if you want
if
to skip forward.
If there's a bulky backpack or something weird looking, you could kind of think, all right, Nad's going to check it. But when you've got a fucking hand hanging out, what else is it going to be?
Yeah. The body is initially identified and given the name Jane Doe number 60. And she was a partially decomposed Caucasian female.
Is the 60 part because that's how many they've currently got rather than just like an arbitrary number? So they've got 60 Jane Doe's sort of in...
With that year.
Okay, in the year. Okay, yes. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's usually what happens, that they stopped doing it continuous because they ended up with such high numbers they couldn't keep track. So like you say, it would be Jane Doe number 60 /84.
Yeah.
Yeah? But she was apparently 5'9" tall and weighed 120 pounds. The body was nude and bound by a single long leather thong ligature. That was a mouthful. That encircled and tied the ankles together, wrapped around the left thigh and tied together the wrists in front of the abdomen. The neck had ligature marks. The nipples had been entirely removed and the skin tissue had been removed from areas on the lower abdomen and left ankle. The body had an S-shaped tattoo on the bottom of the right foot. The ME estimated time of death at 3:30 p.m. 3rd of July to 7:30 p.m. on the 7th of July. That was all around the temperature and all the decomposition that had gone on.
Do you think the you said that she had skin missing around her waist and her ankles, or mm-hmm. ankle at least, and they mm-hmm. said she had a tattoo of an S on her mm-hmm. foot. Was that a recent S tattoo? Is it like he's branding something? I don't think he has an S in his name.
No, there's no indication
so
that...
it might have been her tattoo to get it on her foot.
What I actually think it is he missed it.
Missed it how? What, would he want to get rid of it so to not identify her?
Yes.
So going back, she's got the part missing on her waist and her ankle. Is that either it was removed, do you think? Because there would have been like something on there, like a tattoo, and to remove it.
No.
General removal.
Surgically
for
removed.
Like okay.
Surgically removed. And it was the fact that the nipples were taken that made me... Anyway, the timeline here, we've got the 3rd to the 6th of July 1984. Okay, so we've got 3-day span. Shari's last seen, the body's found, but she isn't identified at this point. She's just Jane Doe number 60. We know this is Shari, but for now she's Jane Doe number 60. Bill is sharing this apartment with his friends and his friend's mother, as I said. In an adjacent apartment block, it's quite weird how it's described. It's adjacent, but then it's up one floor. They're crammed together. There's a 15-year-old girl, her mother, and three other relatives, one of which is actually a cousin. So five people, small apartment. Early June 1984, all of these relatives, all of these people meet Bill when he's washing his motorbike outside. This is when it was definitely running. They get chatting, as you do, and he tells him he's a photographer. These people from this other apartment continue to bump into Bill. As I said, he's got a car as well, and he offers lifts to one of them frequently. One time, Shari Miller is with Bill in the car, so the relatives meet her and they know of this girl, which again is significant further down the line. This 15-year-old girl is called Tracy Campbell, and her relative that I mentioned that spends time with Bill in a car is male. Bill does a photo shoot on a construction site for the male relative.
Is Bill a prolific photographer? Is he well known? Is he sort of in the industry? Or is it just sort of he's doing it for, if someone's like a handyman, they'll do it for friends or family. They'll do it for people they know in the street in the town, but they're not actually qualified in anything. They can just be a handyman. Is this person a photographer and he can take pictures of people? Because it's in the 80s, how many people had a portable camera at that point? Probably just him, right? So you can kind of be a photographer just because there's no one else has one.
Yes.
And what I'm wondering, is he actually like a photographer in like a job sense? You know, that's what
no,
his
he's not.
Is.
He's not Bill Bailey. He's a wannabe. He's living. He's sharing an apartment, living, sleeping on a sofa. He hasn't got the money to buy the high end photography equipment. He hasn't got the space or the money again to set up his own darkroom. So he's doing this photo shoot on a construction site with this male relative. And my instinct was like, oh, hell, you'd never get anywhere near a construction site these days for health and safety reasons, security up the yin yang. You know, you fall down a hole, you break your leg, and the construction site still gets sued, even though you're a trespasser.
In the UK, I think it's the Health and Safety Act 1984.
Yeah.
So this would have been prior 1984, wouldn't it? Or is this in 1984?
This is 1984.
Obviously, this is in the UK. It's very different, right?
Yeah. But the fact is, it was a male having a shoot on a construction site. So I'm immediately going, okay, that sounds very macho, lots of oil. And I'm thinking, was this a... It's never revealed, but you can imagine where my brain was going, that maybe he was aiming for a particular market.
Yeah.
To sell these photographs on. There is no evidence he ever actually did sell them.
Why was the oil a thing? There's lots of oil on the work site. That doesn't mean they're interested in oil.
If you've ever seen some of the photographs, yeah. It's like mechanics. You'll see a mechanic holding a wrench with a streak of oil down his face.
Yeah, and he's built like a brick shit house.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether this relative was built like one of those, I don't know, but yeah. Bill and this relative, they spend a lot of time together. They get these films developed at a shop locally, and they spend a lot more quality boys' time together at local bars. Now, young Tracy, she likes the idea of becoming an international model, so she asks Bill to help her. She pops round. He surprisingly refuses. He says he doesn't take photographs of minors. And that had me a bit, okay. That doesn't...
More attention, maybe, if he kills her? Sorry, I'm speculating. Wait till the end. Carry on.
No, that's a valid... That was where my brain was going when I was doing this. And the fact is, if he's told her no, would she then go immediately back and tell the rest of the family and her mother, oh, I asked Bill and he said no. So he thinks, no matter what I do, I'm off the hook because I've already said no and she must have told them. But anyway, Tracy goes missing on the 12th. Everyone starts searching for her. There's no sign of Bill and the relatives... Tracy's relatives do go looking for him and they notice his car's missing. The 13th, Tracy's reported as missing to the police. Now I'm thinking, why did they? But it wasn't that timeline. It was like the afternoon of the 12th and they reported her missing on the 13th. They didn't do this waiting 24 hours. And they were taken seriously by the police, which again, even then, incredibly unusual. Her mother strongly suspects Bill has her, as they'd been seen together, her and Bill. Last time anybody saw her, she was with Bill, and she tells everybody in the apartment complex that Bill's got her. The mother of Bill's housemate, you know, the one that he's sleeping on the sofa, she also starts telling people in the apartment complex that she thinks Bill has something to do with Tracy going missing. Now, there's another neighbour. He's watching people come and go, as you do. He's obviously, everybody's on high alert. So everybody's glued to their windows and, you know, just trying to look for Tracy. And he notices Bill going into this apartment where he's supposed to be living on the afternoon of the 13th. So Tracy's been reported missing in the morning. This is in the afternoon. The guy hot-foots it over there and he basically barges in through the door and demands to know from Bill where Tracy is. Bill's response was strange to say the least. Apparently, there's a coffee table sat in front of this sofa, and on it, there's a pile of pornographic magazines. And he picks one of them up, waves it at him, and says, look at some pictures. So the neighbour's less than happy at the response, and he gets quite confrontational, and he asks Bill, you know, where he'd been.
I had skeptical hippo eyes. My eyes sort of closed, and I'm like, why?
Yeah.
You barge in, where is she? And you're like, did you know my fridge is cold? You'd be like, the fuck? That's good. And then if you're just like, do you want to just watch some porn? Just want to look at some tits? Right? That's not the question. Yeah.
I know. It was just, I'm surprised he didn't knock his block off, actually. But anyway, so he asked where Bill had been. And he gets told, taking photos in the desert. So the neighbour then hot-foots it down to this parking garage area and looks at Bill's car. And it's clean. Yes, he could have washed it, but the neighbour in his mind's eye...
Isn't this only like the same day or something? One's in the morning, one's in the afternoon.
Seen on the 12th, and this is the afternoon, the 13th, so it's like 24
okay,
so hours.
It's, yeah. It's been a day.
Yeah.
I mean, if you are going to kill someone, you probably would sort of clean up stuff as quickly as possible. But do you actually get it as clean as possible and then leave a car in a place that's going to be found easily? If you've done it, it's kind of like, okay, if... Do you know what I mean? If you have nothing to hide, you show people stuff, but then... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
if his car's that clean less than a day later, you kind of think, well, maybe it wasn't him then.
Yeah.
That's what I would... But obviously, it doesn't solve anything.
No. So obviously this guy, you know, he thinks, oh, I've got you, because his car's clean. If he's been in the desert, it should have been covered in sand. Is you're thinking, if it's covered in sand, was that a disposal site? But so either way, it doesn't add up. But he thinks, oh, gotcha. And he goes off to tell Tracy's mum. So Tracy's mum is like, right, okay, I'm going to talk to the police. Bill, for some reason, a couple of hours later, goes to Tracy's apartment and tells her mother that he hadn't seen her after dropping her off at a local store on the afternoon of the 12th. So, you know, sort of, it was by this point, almost 30 hours later. It was early afternoon on the 12th. So he goes over on the 13th, the evening. This male relative that's been really close with Bill is there at the same time, obviously. And he asks Bill why his car was clean if he'd been out in the desert. And he says it's because he had to clean it inside and out after a heater caught fire. Who cleans a car out if a heater caught fire?
Although if it smells, if it pumps out, so if it pumps out smoke into the car, you would clean the inside, wouldn't you? And you clean the outside because it's sandy. Slight background thing: the other week, our tumble dryer almost set fire. So I can relate to that because that fucking made everything smell. I'm walking around the kitchen with a protein shake. I can smell toast. I turn around, there's just smoke billowing out of a tumble dryer.
It was so, literally within about a minute, wasn't
yeah,
it?
So well? If, and yeah. Because if he's saying his heater set fire or something in his car, it would have pumped smoke because I assume that air quote air conditioning would have been on or some sort of blower. It would have pumped everything through into the car, I imagine. So you could say, I cleaned the whole thing out because it smells.
Yeah, you could. Yeah. I was also thinking, good God, why would you wash the inside of your car because of electrics? Then I'm thinking 1984... There probably wasn't, you know, it wasn't built like a bloody spaceship like most cars are these days. You get in and it's literally like sitting on the deck of the Starship Enterprise with some of them. So all of this stuff gets fed back to the police. All of this, you know, bits and pieces that people have learned. And the police go and visit Bill at home. Not immediately, though. They go on the 14th and then they go again on the 16th of July. And he gives the police the same story each time, but he adds bits on each time. He tells them that Tracy went round to his apartment to make a phone call to her girlfriend because her place didn't have one. I mean, they're obviously not wealthy. There's five of them living in this very small apartment. He then dropped her off at a local store and she was going to go to the beach afterwards. And, oh, by the way, she wanted to be a model. He threw that in. Yeah. So he lets them look around the apartment and look at his vehicle. No warrant. So they have to play nice. No big digging around. They can't move things and stuff. And they find nothing blindingly obvious, okay? So, as I said, each time he's told something to someone, it's been slightly different.
But that's not uncommon, though.
No, no. But people's radars with him, they're not good. Skip forward a couple of weeks. 31st of July. The police arrest him and serve search warrants. They take his car and they start on the apartment. So, recap. Shari's last seen on the 3rd of July. We're now with Bill on the 31st of July, and he's been arrested on the suspicion of the suspected murder of Tracy.
Okay, so they've not found Tracy, that's why it's suspected murder, and it's been 10 days.
Yes.
Why?
Exactly. There is nothing in anything that actually tells you the why. That struck me as really, really odd. But they seem to have been really convinced that Tracy was dead, the police, that is. When you think she's literally been gone
10 days in the 80s in LA.
Yes.
It is pretty. Kids run away, though.
Yeah. I mean, I thought, well, maybe that they went down and asked the stores. 1984. Was there CCTV back then? I think we've covered this before. Even if there was, it would have been, you know, like looking at a fuzzy screen with no signal on the TV. There probably was no sightings. And as you say, kids run away. Children have been killed and just marked as runaways. So I was really rather impressed that they didn't do that. And it did make me wonder if they investigated Bill's background and found the fact that he was on bail for this sexual assault and they found other stuff that just gave them the heebie-jeebies. There was something. They found a box in a hall cupboard in this apartment and it had all sorts of bits of jewellery in it and car's keys. In the car, the officers discovered two Polaroid photographs, as well as a camera bag containing photographs, negatives, and other camera equipment. And they found other Polaroids as well. So, again, no developing. You can take pictures of whatever you want without any consequences. Now, apparently, under the floorboards of the car, which got me thinking, floorboards? Cars don't have wooden floorboards. So Maybe it was a really old vehicle where they did.
Well, no, you can probably peel a panel up.
Yeah, it's described as floorboards, but because I don't know what the make and model of the vehicle was.
It makes more sense, I guess, if it's a footboard.
They were obviously hidden because they found a keychain with several keys and they had three, you know, like the loop rings attached as well. So the police take all this evidence, all the camera bag, the photographs and everything, and they take it back to the station and they put it on what was known as the homicide desk. Now, I thought about that and presumably they can't put this into evidence until he's charged. He may have been arrested, but he hasn't actually been charged. And if he's released, they might have to hand it back. So it's on this homicide desk, as they called it.
Do they have to give it back, though? Because I know there's a big issue where if something gets put in as evidence, it just goes missing. And then people never get it back. It could be stuff worth a lot of money, heirlooms, engagement rings, loads of stuff. And it just never gets given back.
Yeah, exactly. There are some times that they're allowed to, again, we're talking American law and we're talking the 1980s. There are some times where they have to give things back and there are other times when they're allowed to keep hold of these things for ongoing investigation. Certainly in the UK, it's a different set of rules now how these things are handled. But they plonk them on this homicide desk. So it's literally in the middle of the office. Apparently, these Polaroids I said, the two of them, they depicted a young woman asleep in a vehicle. There were several negatives and photographs inside the camera bag, and they depicted the same young woman posing at various locations in the desert. The people working on the homicide of Jane Doe number 60 saw these photographs on that table. And the woman in the photographs taken from Bill's car had an ankle tattoo in the same area of the body where the skin had been removed from the body of Jane Doe number 60. And they thought at that point, there's a connection. So an LAPD forensic expert matched the fingerprints of Jane Doe number 60 to those of Shari Miller. And it was taken from a record of an arrest in 1980. And her mother was actually informed on the 1st of August of Shari's death. We have Bill in custody, yeah? They ask him a lot of questions about Tracy. Where is she? And Shari. But I'm guessing that the DA was telling him they needed more. So he was released on the 3rd of August. It's not said anywhere that I could find it, but he was probably bailed pending further investigations. You know, as I said, that's what we do in the UK, but 1980s in the LA, I don't know. But they do carry on investigating him. The keys that were found under this car's floorboard, one was actually discovered to fit the locks and ignition of both Shari's vehicle and Bill's housemate's mum's car. So you've got the unfortunate thing in 1984 where you've got one key fits two vehicles. And I've actually had that happen. I've had neighbours many years ago knock on the door. We've locked our keys in our car. You've got the same car model. Can you see if your key...
That would have had to be years ago with the old without central locking.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Googling it, by the way, it is what I said it was. It is pretty much the footwell. Because the bottom of the car isn't the part that you see, is it?
No.
There is another layer and it's that. You can lift that up.
So... they go to speak to employees in this shop where Bill would get his photographs developed. He'd brought in films for developing on July the 6th, the 9th, the 18th, the 24th, and then August the 9th. You say he gets released on the 3rd of August. So he's still taking photographs in all the way through. And among the negatives submitted during that period were those that depicted Shari. So, say... on August the 9th, when Bill goes to take the last lot in, he goes to the photography shop and he asks to speak with an employee he usually dealt with. And he asks to speak to them outside the shop. So the pair of them are stood outside. And Bill told this employee that he knew the police were following him. And he pointed to a car down the street and he said, you know, police are sat in that watching me. And he wanted to know what this employee had actually told the police all about him. It's not clear whether they actually did tell him that maybe they just sort of, I don't know, you're a customer. So they go back inside. Bill pulls out a stack of negatives and he stands there holding them up to the light to work out which ones he wants reprinting. And he eventually requested that 50 to 60 of the negatives are reprinted as photographs. That's a lot of money. He stood there examining, because negatives used to come in strips, if you don't know what they are. They come in a long reel and they're cut off into length, so you would call them a strip. And it's usually sort of like 12 on each one, because most reels were 36, some were 48. And he looks at one of them and he gets a pair of scissors off the counter, apparently, and he cuts this picture, this negative off. He sticks a negative in his mouth and he scrapes the emulsion, as it's called, off with his teeth. And then he hands the strip over and says, print the rest of them off. And I was like, did saliva soften it? The chemicals in it?
Wait, it would have destroyed any sort of base that's left on the image, surely.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the whole reason why he did it. But to do it in front of witnesses, which I thought was just bizarre. You'd have thought he would have done that at home and just not gone in anyway. August the 11th, 2 days later, the police go to an area in the desert that was shaped like a bowl. They're led there by an acquaintance of Bill, who knew the area and had conversations with the police about, you know, his knowledge of Bill and the fact that Bill knew this area. They'd gone camping there, although Bill had denied knowing it to the police. The police then used 75 police officers and trackers and dogs. And they same day, they found a severely decomposed, partially skeletonized body. They'd found Tracy. 5 days later, there's an autopsy. And the results were unable to confirm the exact date of death, but was consistent with the 12th of July being tied up. And then there was ligature strangulation. So they can't say for definite it was the 12th, but it's consistent with the 12th. That was enough to get Bill rearrested on that same day. So what happened next was the reason for the appeal in 1997, which I found most of this, and whether Bill had been secretly recorded by two devices, whether he was legally represented, although he'd asked, and he couldn't get hold of his own lawyer, and it was odd.
What happens if a lawyer drops you as a client? Are they allowed to mid-case? I assume they are. What happens? Does it get transferred to someone new? Does it consider a new trial process, or is it just, oh, this is your new lawyer? I don't know what happens.
I believe they have to ask the court's permission. And they have to have a valid reason that the court will accept. And if the judge will then turn around and say, okay, you can step aside, but in that case, we need either another court-appointed attorney, or it's just for argument's sake, a lawyer will say, I've now got a conflict of interest for whatever reason, but my colleague doesn't have the same conflict. Can they step in for me? And as long as they've got the court's permission, it can be done.
Okay. I just wondered, because you said he's not getting contacted. I thought, shit, what if you don't have a lawyer? Your lawyer just decides, nah, fam, I'm out.
Well, apparently he couldn't get hold of a lawyer. And I thought, well, that's fair enough. These guys, he could have been in court with somebody else. And I think you've got the right to wait until you get the one you want up to a point. And then they'll say, no, if you want legal representation, we're going to appoint one for you. You can ignore them, but we're going to appoint one for you. There's a little bit, did he waive his right to have an attorney present? He said he would talk to them and told the police again, how he'd met and knew Shari and Tracy. But when the detectives told him that they'd found Tracy's body and it was approximately 150 yards away from where Bill's own Polaroids showed Shari, the police actually managed the pictures up from rock formations to show it was the same. And he said he didn't know the area. And they said, excuse me. And he just, I can't explain. And I want a lawyer. So
there is a thing, though. If someone showed me a picture of the woods near here, I said, I don't know that place. They said, look, here's a video of you with a dog. Like, yeah, but I didn't know that's where. What, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they've already got this old acquaintance of his who said, yeah, we used to go camping in that area. Yes, he does know that area. They've got photographs that he's taken of one victim there, and then they found the body of another person in the same area where he's the last person seen with them. So
with pictures of him there, basically.
Yeah, we're doing quite well with this. It is circumstantial, but it's looking good. They go back with warrants properly, and it's not that they know what they're looking for, but they're going really, you know, completely all out now. It's not just almost a scouting expedition anymore.
Don't warrants have to be quite specific, though?
Yeah. Yeah.
So doesn't that mean if they find stuff that isn't related to that, it's not?
Yep. So I think they get more warrants and they go back and they're much more specific. And they find shed loads a bit more. And now it makes sense knowing what they did about the bodies. They find rope. And it was actually in a box in, I said, he's living with his friend and his friend's mother. And it seems the friend and the mother, they both had their own bedrooms. And Bill's sleeping on the sofa. They tear the place apart and they find a box in the friend's room with this rope on it. They haven't got this, they haven't got the forensics at that point where they can tell where it's been cut the same way, but they can tell it's exactly the same type and whatever. And the friend's looking at it saying, well, I've never seen that bloody box before. It's not mine.
It's not my drugs. It's not mine.
Yeah. But I don't think they were really genuinely looking at him. And they also, they've still got Bill's car. Yeah. They didn't let him have that back. And they checked that car over with luminol. Now, luminol isn't the holy grail that TV shows would have you believe it. It does react with vegetables, meat, and I think vinegar, I heard somewhere. So if you've had your shopping bags in the boot of the car or on the back seat, or you've had a takeaway meal or something like that and dropped bits of your kebab in the back and they spray it with luminol, it's going to look like there's been a murder in there, but no. So it didn't come up with anything.
Apparently it reacts with iron.
Yeah.
So anything that's got a high iron concentration, it will react with.
Right. You might like this one. Apparently they did another test called a human precipient test. Again, I think that's another one of these blood test ones. You know, you see them again on the shows where they wipe with a swab and whether it reacts and it turns, whether it's human blood or animal blood. But they didn't get, that came up negative. So they've got actually no evidence that there was any bodies in the car or the apartment. But they've still got enough circumstantial to charge him. And he's locked up. July 1985. So, you know, a year later, it takes that long to get to the preliminary hearing. But remember in the beginning, I said he was on bail for a sexual assault charge before he got attacked Chari. So he's in prison this whole time, you know, waiting trial. And they decide that they're going to make sure he stays put because they're actually going to go full on for this sexual assault originally. He pleads no contest to it. He's obviously, at that point, I'm thinking, okay, he hasn't got a leg to stand on. He's just going to hold his hands up. He gets 8 years.
So, for the sexual assault?
Yeah. That's
The weight of all that on top of you, though, that must be so psychologically destructive. Okay, you've got that going on in the background anyway. Then you kill people, and I'm not sympathising with him here. He's being punished for what he did. He's not being cancelled. He's being appropriately dealt with. You're dealing with the stress of all of that, and then you've got this other stressor of the murders that you've potentially committed up to this point, and they're being tried for that. And then you get sentenced for that thing. That must be so hard to keep on top of all that, that the other stuff is just going to crumble around it. You can't keep stories straight, the stress of this and that. You might not have the fortitude to keep arguing, coming up with lies and keeping it straight. That must be would be difficult to defend yourself with. And I don't mean the weight of in guilt of, I did this stuff. I mean, if you're getting, say you did something wrong at work and you're getting in trouble for that, your car's got an issue and then your partner's moaning at you. If there were all of those individually, they were manageable. Yeah. But when they get added together, they're worth more than the sum of the parts.
That's fair enough.
And it's the same thing with that. He's getting, if it was just a sexual assault thing, maybe you could deal with it. Just a murder thing. Okay, sure. But you're getting all of this stuff on top, man. I think that's probably overwhelmed him to keep stuff straight.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah. So I said 1985, he has a preliminary hearing. Then he gets convicted of this other thing. So he's got 8 years. So they know that he's in there while they get everything sewn up on this other case. So 1988, he goes to a full trial. And this was a two-phase trial, as we've come across before. This was a jury trial. And you've got the innocent or guilt finding of the first part. Then, if guilty, there is the penalty phase of the second part of this trial.
By second part, do you mean it's Chari and Tracy, or do you mean it as a whole?
He goes to trial for both murders. The first part...
And does that determine whether or not he's guilty? And then the second part determines what the sentencing is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's exactly it. But we end up with the idiot for a client trope when he fires his attorney and he offers no evidence in his defence at all. Now, he doesn't have to prove he's not guilty. The prosecution has to prove his guilt. We know that. But with all the evidence against him, he does nothing. No expert witnesses, nothing. The state will actually pay for the experts and the lawyers. They may not be the best ones or the ones you want, but you will get them on a death penalty case. He's not far off indigent. He literally had a motorbike and a car. He had nothing else and a few bits of cameras. So he's not paying for all of this. He's found guilty by the jury with special circumstances. They tacked that on, which is they called it multiple murders because of Shari and Tracy. So obviously he's been found guilty. So we go into the penalty phase of the trial. And this is where you do find out what an utter scumbag this guy has always been. Of previous convictions or charges can actually be revealed to the jury at that point. They're kept out of the first one. He had sexual assault and attempted sexual assault cases, charges up the river. They started in 1972 that we know
up the
of.
River?
Yeah. Yeah, I was trying to think of, yeah. I'm getting furious again thinking about it. There were at least five people who testified at the penalty phase of what he did to them. There were pages and pages of evidence. And when my hair started to curl by itself and I stopped reading it, in all the evidence, it stated that in 1978, he was charged with sexually assaulting his wife in Michigan. And in 1980, accused but seemingly never charged with another sexual assault. So loads of people are rocking up and actually saying, he did this to me, he did that to me. And he just sits there through all of it. So you would think, wouldn't you, that if you hadn't done these things and somebody stood up and said, you know, that person did this to me, he'd be jumping up and down and shouting and yelling and saying, I didn't, that never happened.
Is that not a slight fallacy, though, where because you're trying so hard to, if you're a kid and you farted, And you're trying to argue that I didn't fart because you're screaming and shouting about it. It's like, well, you definitely farted. Otherwise, you wouldn't be trying so hard to convince other people.
Or blame it on the dog.
Yeah, so it's. I think it might be one of those fallacy things because then if you jump and start screaming, people are like, of course you did it. Why are you defending yourself so hard? If you really didn't do it, you wouldn't be bothered by it. But then if you don't do it, people are like, you've got no defence. It's you know,
yeah,
what I mean? It's a vicious circle. It seems like a fallacy to me.
Yeah, you're probably not wrong, but I would have... The other person in me would be sat there saying, I would be saying, that didn't happen. That did not happen. That is a lie. That did not happen. But he doesn't. He just sits there.
I mean, you can't really just do that in court. During
you can, because he's defended. He's his own lawyer.
No, when someone's out there saying this shit happened to me, you can't be like, no, you can't just do that. Like, Donald Trump, wrong. You can't, no. You have to follow certain procedures, right? So, again, it's not as straightforward as disagreeing with them. And then if you disagree with them, it's like hearsay. I know this is a fallacy to, I think it's like populum. Like the amount of people that come up against you to argue it doesn't necessarily even mean it's true. But when you've got evidence of it happening, that probably means it's true. And if you've got evidence of these five other people that are coming towards or whatever, that's evidence in itself.
That's evidence because they're saying that, but he has got the right to cross-examine them and he could have stood up there and said, you say this happened in such and such a place. Did you see me do X, Y, Z or something? He does nothing. He didn't. The only thing he did do was his statement on his closing argument at the penalty phase. The reports that you read out there from the newspapers and the like, they attribute this to the first part of the trial, the actual guilt phase. But it's not correct. This was actually at the penalty phase. But just listen to the actual words. I'll try not to do an inflection, but he said as his final statement, think of how many you don't even know about. You are so right. That's it. And by this time, I think everybody is, yep, nope, you're done. And he's given the death sentence in May 1988. You know, think how many you don't know about. You're so right. That's it. So you start thinking, bloody hell, there's probably another 50 out there. You just...
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah. But he appeals. They all do. Seemingly, he didn't get a lawyer for any of his multiple appeals, and he did them all himself. And they are extensive and complex, but nothing stuck. All of them were without merit. Everything he tried, even this, you know, was he secretly being recorded? And, you know, whether he was Mirandized properly, whether he should have had a lawyer. But they followed. There was a lot of case law around how he was dealt with, and nothing worked. 1998. He'd been on death row in San Quentin for 10 years. And he decides to drop all of these appeals he started and finally get a lawyer to speed up his execution. He's had enough. Yeah. 5 days before he's due to be executed, he changes his mind, starts hollering he's innocent, and it all comes to a screeching halt again. So 8 more years pass. Bill sat festering and fuming in jail, probably still throwing appeals out like they're going out of fashion. When in 2006, LA seems to have gotten a hold of $14 million to look at old cold cases. Police had long suspicions, apparently, and reading the trial transcripts, the prosecutors did too, that Bill Bradford may be much worse than the public knew. And I think his final statement probably, you know, capped that off. So remember that homicide desk we talked about? They'd put the Polaroids and the other photos on there when they linked up Shari Miller to Jane Doe number 60. There were other photographs. No one looked at those very hard. Probably no time, no resources. But that $14 million let them do it. 54 pictures. The LA police released a data sheet which depicted headshots taken from the photos. So it's like a contact sheet, we'd call it. There were a lot more photographs, hundreds, but that 54 were the key. Now, they whittled down the photographs to what they thought were 47 women who were possible victims of Bill.
How did they narrow that down? Or how did they get the scope of those men and women?
They put the 54 out. People start coming to them. Within 2 weeks, sheriff's officials fielded more than 2,000 calls as from as far away as England. And they had 700 lines of inquiry. Yeah, but they've got 14 million quid to play with. So they've got lots of resources on this. So they've got 47. One of those was identified is it was the sister of CSI Miami actress Eva LaRue. The CSI Miami episode Darkroom is actually based on this case. She wasn't a victim. It seemed that Bill had stalked her. He'd taken loads and loads and loads of photographs that she knew nothing about. I'm assuming as well that everybody who had a family member, female family member, go missing late 70s to 84 was probably ringing this police hotline as well, wouldn't they? So, yeah. July the 28th, 2006. Bill rings his lawyers. Yeah, he's got one again. And he says he will talk to the police if they want to visit. The police are, but nah, He's game playing. He's got no reason to talk to us. He could say whatever he likes. He's in there. He's not going anywhere. He's going to play games. But they changed. The police decided they did. They changed their mind. And they say, let's talk. And Bill's lawyers was, well, they probably stopped photos anyway. And the pictures are over 20 years old. He won't remember who any of these are. It's a waste of time. But Bill says, no, I'll talk to you. So they sit down. The police had actually identified, by this point, all but 14 of the women on the photographs. Apparently a few of those original 47 we talked about were Bill's ex-wives. So detectives, they'd linked at least 4 of the women in these photographs to bodies found dumped in various parts of northern LA. Well, it's actually northern Los Angeles County, so the city and the county.
Yeah, there's like a greater area of LA, isn't there? Same, there's London and there's the greater area of London.
Yeah. So authorities still hadn't identified these bodies, but they said that the manner in which the bodies were dumped was similar to the methods used in the murders by Bill, that he was, you know, the ones that he was convicted of. In addition, Bill is continued to be a suspect in the killing of 2 other women in the Los Angeles area. A Patricia Dulong, who was 34, was found dead in Santa Monica in September 1975. And a Donnelly Duhamel, who was 31, was killed in August 1978. And her body was found on this old Topanga Road in Malibu. And authorities knew that she'd met with Bill Bradford in a bar in Culver City. There's still people around who knew him, would talk. Yep. Yeah. So they have 6 bodies. And they really want to know the answer for those 6. Did Bill kill these? And who are the 4 that we don't know who they are? Do you know who they are? We're pretty sure you've killed them. But who are they? Let us return them to their families. And they've got 14 unknowns, complete unknowns that they don't know are alive, dead, let alone they don't know who they are. So the Bill and the police talk over 2 days. And he conceded knowing some of the 14 and some of the, you know, the six. But he refused to provide details to any of the questions and answers. And he also denied killing them. Then the inconsiderate bastard dies of cancer on the 13th of March, 2008.
How rude of him.
Yeah. His age was at the time was given as being 61. So you can understand why I'm not sure about when he was born because
yeah,
be the part of the year. So that's the end of the case. We're going to go into the case autopsy after we've gone and got ourselves a cup of coffee and we'll be right back. And I can't put my teeth in. Let's start that one again.
No, we're going to keep that one. That's what I had to deal with last week, but it was worse. So that's why I had to do it. And yeah.
Sorry.
So that's why I said, right, we're going to go to the case autopsy. We're going to be back with the coffee. We'll see you in a bit. That was better, right? So yeah, we'll be back in a minute. Hello, and we're back. That's usually where you talk.
Sorry.
Why did you pause? We're back. This is playing. This is recording.
I was going to cough, and you moan at me when I cough. Right. So, quick recap. Bill Bradford, American, born 1946, 48 maybe. Multiple marriages, one child. Lived all over the USA as well, which is, again, he may have got a lot more. Convicted of killing Shari Miller and Tracy Campbell within a 2-week period. Trophy collector. Took police 20 years to actually look into these photographs and discover possibly 20 more victims, 14 of which are still unidentified and no bodies to tie in. 6 have been matched to bodies attributed to him. So there's some really weird reports that the trials was in 1987. There's a really long and complex Reddit post which has a lot of unverifiable information and some really interesting theories. But the writer admits that all the links to the evidence are dead. The Wayback Machine doesn't have any. I did try. And so honestly, I wasn't comfortable using it to write the case. So though it's a good read, and I've linked it in the show notes, I haven't used it. Wikipedia, it had a quarter of a page on this guy. Murderpedia had a lot more, but it's not comprehensive. Most of it seems to have come from when he died. They pulled a load of information up and reused it. But some of it was as we know, it gets twisted. It's hinky. That what was me falling over that appeal document by pure chance. And I apologise for the gaps that I do have about his background and such. Even the regurgitated stuff about the tenuous link to CSI Miami had errors in it. So got me wondering, what did he do for a living? He could afford to run a car and a motorbike and all that photography stuff, and even developing the films, if nothing else. It's not cheap, and there's nothing.
You don't know if he sold that stuff on, though.
No,
you don't. You don't know what other sort of circles there are that you could potentially do that to. The niche or weirder the thing, the more you can charge for it.
Yeah.
But then where do you find that? Because back then, you wouldn't have had the means to meet those people unless you literally hang around physically in those circles.
There was a lot of back pages in magazines back then, Cameron, with really strange little adverts in them, and especially in a place like LA, you'd walk past phone booths. It's not a thing now, but it was then, and certainly in London, you'd walk around and they would literally be brimming. They looked like they looked like trees. They were rammed full of business cards from various ladies of the night through to photocopying services.
But yeah, because especially back then though, the tier of photography and stuff like that you could collect in a portable sense would have been so low that anyone that just had a camera would immediately be good or wanted.
Yeah.
Be wanted for it. It's like if you're a teenager and you've got one friend that can get weed. He's the cool one. He's the cool guy because he's got a camera.
Yeah, probably right, yeah. So those sexual assault charges for his wife, that made me raise my eyebrows again because back then, marriage and assault were often just called a domestic, weren't they? And they were ignored no matter how badly injured either party was. Heck, even some countries now don't recognise sexual assault within a marriage. So maybe it was an ex-wife-to-be or soon-to-be. Now, Shari Miller, according to Bill Bishop, he had known her for 2 years. He told the police she was getting divorced and wanted to go back to college to become a graphic artist. no indication that that was true, but that's what he said in the police interviews. That photo shoot with Shari. One thing I didn't mention was that Shari had had an accident and had 5 stitches in her arm after falling and cutting it open. I'm sure I read somewhere that the suture material they used was blue. Anyway, it's a cut, and that actually helped them with Shari's identification with her medical records when they found her, along with the fingerprints. And I was a little, would a real photographer want to take photographs with somebody with obvious blue stitches and apparently a bandage on her arm?
How clear is it going to be in the photography, because it's a Polaroid? And I know it's the case now where if someone has something weird, that can be really appealing in images, because you might get models that when you look at them, they might be conventionally sort of unattractive. They might have like, I don't remember what it's called, but you know the gap in the middle of the teeth. Maybe they've got like a port wine stain or something. It can still be a draw. It can be, look at that. That's kind of striking or different, but it's not a put off in any sense.
Yeah.
So if she's got this cut or a stitch or whatever, it could just be like, and you don't know what the pictures could be. It could be for like anything that could be remotely alt, like alternative. I mean, that's my take on it. I don't know. I'm an idiot, but.
He probably talked her into it. I mean, he talked at least 4 women into marrying him. So all those trinkets that the police found in the cupboard at the apartment, he said they were given to him by Shari. They were jewellery.
Well, was she like a fucking magpie? What do you mean he gave her all this stuff?
Yeah.
She gave him all of the keys and the jewellery and stuff.
He said that Shari wanted the jewellery remounted or added to. There was a medallion that was supposed to go on something. This girl was living out of a car. No way did she bother about these. These were trophies, like the photos, like the keys. Like, what did he do with those nipples?
All right, do you reckon she had a nipples pierced or something? And that could have been identified. But then you just take the nipple piercings out, wouldn't you, rather than take the nipple off?
What did he do with them? It's because obviously we haven't got transcripts of the actual interviews. All we can do is assume that they asked him, and maybe whatever he said, they just didn't want to use for whatever.
It's reminding me of Dexter, the TV show, which I don't think you watch much of. He's got an obsession with blood. As a kid, he was covered in blood for a long period of time. And it just grew up and he became fascinated with it. So when he kills people, he kills bad people, he takes a drop of their blood and puts it in one of those the sample things that you take for a microscope. Mm-hmm. And he keeps their blood in an air vent in his house. And that's a trophy, but that's the kind of trophy where you couldn't have an excuse for it. I'd want to take one that would be one you could keep out in public view all the time, because that's going to remind you of it. As if you tuck it away, it's not quite so much a trophy, because when you take a trophy or you win a medal, you want that stuff on display, don't you? This is what I did. It's to commemorate the event. But if you have something like that that's always tucked away, it's a bit different. It's not so much a trophy anymore as it is a collectible.
Yes and no. My understanding from what I've read and heard about some of these, it's the sheer act that the fact they've got it. So it is a memento. It's a trophy, but it's a memento, and they don't need it on show. It's the knowing that they've got it and they can get it out in their own private time and look about and relive the moments.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, you've got Ed Gein that springs to mind, don't you? With, you know, trophy. You talked about shoes. There's an immediate one that springs to mind. I think he got away with it for 20 years. Might cover that one. That's quite an interesting one, actually. Right. Keys. You know, I said he took the keys and they found that the keys matched.
Multiple cars.
2 cars. Yeah. As I said, Shari lived in a car. Even though she lived in the car, she was tidy. She kept the plate, all her clothes stacked up neatly, everything was tidy. When the police found her car, which was tucked away behind another bar a couple of days after she'd gone missing, it looked like a bomb had gone off in it. And I think that's when he got these trophies, when he took the jewellery and the like.
And rooting through her car.
Rooting through her car for trophies for stuff he could keep. Was he a full-on serial killer? I think it's very probable, don't you?
At worst, he's a serial offender. Well, sorry, not worst. At minimum, he's a serial offender.
Yeah.
I mean, he's killed by the looks of 2 people, so I think that might qualify him as a serial killer, because there's a difference between serial, mass, and spree killer.
Yeah.
You won't know about the rest of them. There's 14 possible victims identified.
Well, there's 6 that they are pretty sure are his. They've got 4 bodies that are pretty sure that he's responsible for, but they haven't identified them. And then you've got these 14 that they don't know if they're alive or dead or who they are. So, yeah, I mean, he gets to 38, 40 years old with nothing prior. We know he's got very prolific sexual assault prior to this. So
that you can confirm, but prior stuff, if this is what he's done up until this point and there's such a backlog of stuff, you know he'd done stuff prior. It's just what is reported at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
And if it's in different places, I don't know if there'd be communication across counties like that between...
Yep.
Because there wouldn't be a central database at that point.
Well, some of the stuff still doesn't always tie up. Doesn't, especially if it's historic, it won't make it from the archives into the current databases. So there's been no press releases about these 14 possibilities. So unless somebody randomly spots a photograph and thinks, oh, that looks like my cousin Joe in 1979, you wouldn't...
You hear about people that find out they were stolen, don't you?
Yeah.
As babies. They'll check something. They'll check like a news report or on this day, this kid went missing. Like, hang on, that's me. And they find out their parents were... They kidnapped them from the hospital or something.
So there's one immediate case that springs to mind. It definitely happened. It was a USA case and it didn't end well because the woman in question, because I think she was a teenager at the point that this all came out, she wouldn't have anything to do with her birth family and she stuck by the kidnapper. And you can kind of understand why. She said, you know...
Yeah, it's hard when they're your family.
Yeah, she's been a good mother to me. I understand the pain they're going through, but I don't want to know them. She's my mother. And it didn't end well. It did end up in a bum fight in the press. And it was one of those situations where you sort of like, you get really uncomfortable. And the ones I have seen much more recently like this, so I've got no idea. Well, I do probably understand why. China. It's incredibly common in China for children to reappear in their 30s. And it turns out, you know, dad took them to the market, let go of the hand for 30 seconds and they were gone. And they've spent the last 30 years looking for them and they were stolen and they were brought up. They usually had good lives, but they were stolen and then sold because you were talking the one child.
Yeah. And has that been lifted?
Yeah.
That because there's not enough women or something?
I think it got lifted to two. And then I think it may be there's talk of it being completely dropped. We had a very famous case in the UK now, I think about it. There was a baby stolen from hospital. And again, it's often a knee-jerk reaction that then causes things to change that. There was a baby that was stolen, newborn, literally a couple of hours old. The mother thought it was a nurse taking her out. The hospital staff thought it was a nurse and she just walked straight out of the hospital with her.
If you act like you belong, people think you belong.
Yeah.
They just walk with confidence, nick the baby, take it home.
Yeah, I remember it was all over the press. It was a huge case back in the 80s. And I think she was found about 3 days later when she was telling the family, oh, look at my new baby. And the family were like,
you weren't pregnant. Where'd you get this baby from?
Yeah, something right. And it was kind of a start of the phenomenon of these sort of things happening. And they changed that. That's why they have alarms on doors. And
it's always been a really weird phobia of mine. Not necessarily a phobia, but I had it as a kid. I was thinking, because it does happen when the babies are mixed up.
Yeah.
And you get sort of sent home with, like, air quote, the wrong parents, right? Like, what do you do? I was just thinking about that as a kid. I think, what if this isn't my real family?
I read a case. Well, yeah, I always thought I was adopted. And that may explain a few things. But I read of a case this week when there was two children that were swapped in a Spanish hospital. And when they realised, I didn't actually read it in depth, so I'm not quite sure how old they were when they realised that these children had been swapped. They were very young. The mothers moved in together and raised both children together. So they said they couldn't separate them because they loved them both. It was just such a lovely way of dealing with it. Most people, I don't think, could have coped with that, but... Yeah,
yeah, and no one's at fault. You come together, you can raise your kids codependently, almost. Yeah. You've then got an untraditional family.
So they've got you've got a sister that you isn't a sister, but is as close as any sister.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite sweet. Yeah, it's a Spanish case. So going back to our one, taking a photograph of the victims is a thing. I felt sick when how many have done this? There was even a top 10 list of killers with old-fashioned now photographs. They literally, the ones, and I'm really bad. I looked through it. Yep, I know that one. I know that one. And no, I'm not going to go into it. I was going to start quoting them, and I thought, no, I'll be here all night. It even took me into looking at Samuel Little. This is a guy that blew up in the press a couple of years ago, I think because he died at the time. But he was the guy who drew the victims for the police. And I think there was a phenomenal amount. There was something like 100 victims. you know, he'd been convicted of whatever he'd been convicted of. He was locked up for life, and the police, and he goes to the police and said, yeah, there was a few more. And he starts drawing. And the police were saying, oh, these are lifelike, but they...
I have seen the pictures.
They're not.
They're not lifelike, but it doesn't mean that they're bad, because art is subjective. And it's a specific art style. Now, they are bad. They do look like Stevie Wonder did it. They aren't good, but...
Would you recognise a relative from them?
Well, they're not my relatives. So when I look at them, I don't think that's my cousin. But I probably could, because if it's like it looks like a caricature.
Yeah.
They've got certain features exaggerated, and you can identify them. But, like, oh, that's Cameron. Oh, that's Tim. Oh, that's... I think you probably could.
He's done this from memory. He didn't take photographs. But then it got me thinking, right, okay, what have we all got? Usually no more than a foot away from your left or right hand at any time, 24/7 these days, that are probably going to change.
The phones, yeah. They've track everything. They've got recordings, pictures. They have composites of what your face looks like from different angles, the way they get uploaded. There are people that are paranoid about the vaccine being a tracking chip. You've got a phone in your pocket, love. That's a tracking chip.
Yeah. When you look at how fast that technology has moved and how slow the original technology from pinhole camera to the 18, whatever it was I said, and then, you know, 20th century, and then suddenly we've got...
There's a principle called Moore's Law, and it's the transistors on a microchip will double, like, every 2 years.
Yeah.
That's why stuff gets faster and faster and stronger more powerful computer-wise. Since when I was a kid, I had flip phones like a Motorola, and now you look at an iPhone, which is more powerful than like the computer that put man on the moon. An iPhone is literally more powerful.
Yeah.
And I think now they're getting into problems with quantum effects, where an electron can just suddenly jump across, and I think, oh shit, that's not supposed to do that anymore.
What, on phones?
On like chips and stuff, because like where a current electricity should be running across a certain point, it can just do like a quantum tunneling effect and leap to a different line that's not supposed to be on. So they're going to struggle to get them smaller. Eventually it's going to stop. But it's the amount that phones have improved compared to like the Polaroids that they were using. It's just it accelerated so fast that now, I mean, now murders get caught and put onto live leak because people are live streaming it to Facebook and stuff, aren't they? So, yeah. I mean, that's where you get like red rooms and stuff on the dark web, but I don't know if there's been actually any reported cases of those being real. And a red room is something that you'd go to, which is just that. It's people like live feeds of people killing other people.
Oh, and so it's snuff.
But it's called a red room where people are getting, I think you can probably like pay to have this happen to that person and you can do stuff like that. That's what the reportings are, but I don't know if that's any stuff has actually been proven. But how would you prove that it's real or not? There are people on YouTube that will go into these deep dives where they go into the dark web and tours and stuff like that. And they will look and try to find these things. And it's like, as like investigative,
it just takes you down that rabbit hole of just how dark humanity can be. It's like this guy. I mean, we've got these 14 victims still out there. Well, we don't know that they're victims. We don't know who they are. They might be alive and living their best life, as you say, completely off the grid. So hopefully somebody will come up with something at some day. But so finally, just recapping, last word for the victims. Shari Miller, who was 21, and Tracy Campbell, who was 15.
So thank you very much for listening. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Murder Me and Monday Podcast and email us at murdermeandmondaypodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next time. Cheers.
Bye. What did he do with those nipples?